Chapter 12. Minds Inside. Lips shiver. Parched tongue licks at trailing sweat droplets. Through eyelid cracks, she sees dawn glow on the rough wall and beyond, her companions silhouetted. Riding the rolling, convulsing river of her body, their comforting touches on arm, wrist, said, "We are watching, waiting." Moving to meet a new aching crescendo, roughened old hands pull her to kneel. The world shrinks as she closes her eyes, and yet it inflates, a dark blood singularity where nothing exists except this moment. This enormous surging within. She feels, sees the baby squeezing down inside. The force ebbs, but the others mutter and keep her up, and they're right, because muscle heave returns, unstoppable, like a pounding bison mob. Ragged herd breaths filling the air, or are they hers, as she unfolds into a new configuration? Suddenly the birth scorches hot, and even as legs still thrash in her belly, she reaches down to find a tiny head, slick pelted like an otter, fragile as a swan's egg. One last bone-cracking effort breaks free the cascade and a slippery form is scooped up onto her stomach by the hands all around. Her shaking arms clasp downy flanks, softer than autumn leather worked through the snows until the teeth ache. Cave dark eyes gaze up at her and she nuzzles the baby, breathes deep of its scent, blood loam rich and heady. What connects you and I today, asking questions about pigment, feathers, or engravings, and the makers of those objects, is that we are all beings of feeling, with hearts that swiftly beat from terror or joy. If Neanderthals found some things beautiful, is it possible to know what, or who, they loved? Even what terrified them? Once again, this is a balancing act, teetering between the solidity of the archaeological record and the possibilities that spin off from it. Thinking through fear is an easier starting point. Always present in Neanderthal minds must have been the predators with whom they coexisted. Even equipped with flame, weapons, and the guile of 100,000 hominin generations before them, encountering cave lions or hyenas would have elicited instinctual dread. On the other hand, cases of carnivore butchery indicate that Neanderthals were able to overcome this. There might even have been recognition of fellow top hunters, especially perhaps wolves, the most cunning of all pack creatures. Other risks they faced were elemental. Lithic movements show that river crossings certainly took place, including huge spans like the Rhone. Even if shallow fords were chosen, danger lapped around bodies as arms held precious things out of the water. A misstep may explain the Torville-la-Rivière arm. And in a world where unexpected icy winds or soaking storms could be life-threatening, exposure might have been feared. Even if Neanderthals had mastered flame within the safe confines of a hearth, the horror of wildfires was a different matter. Perhaps a particular issue during arid phases of the Eemian. And conversely, the absence of fire might also have been disconcerting. When Neanderthals stepped into echoing deep caves like Bruniquel, illumination was vital, and its loss potentially fatal. Outside, northern winter nights would have been long and dark. Even warmed by embers and lit by the cold burning stars, dawn must have been greeted with relief. What about happiness? Whether walking over springy steppe tundra or through grassy forest clearings, Neanderthals very likely experienced the simple joy of sun-warmed skin. Other kinds of contentment are also guaranteed. Human appetites for pleasure are far from unique among our fellow apes, and we must assume that many Neanderthal sexual relations were consensual and fun, though others possibly not. Anatomically, pelvic dimensions point to vaginas very similar to ours, and as penises are tailored to fit, those too were probably more like living men's equipment than that of chimpanzees. Luckily for all concerned, unlike chimps, Neanderthal males lacked the gene for penis spines. While in apes they're more like tiny hardened pebbles than spikes, their presence does affect copulation. Marmosets have sex and orgasms that last twice as long when the spines are removed. We should probably therefore picture Neanderthal sex as more leisurely and satisfying than chimp-style rapid thrusting bouts. Not forgetting clitorises, organs solely existing for pleasure. Unluckily for Neanderthals like us, they probably lacked bonobo-like versions that make face-to-face orgasms easier. But masturbation in some form is pretty much guaranteed, whether during sexual encounters as is found among humans, or more generally for social bonding and diffusing tensions, as in bonobos, where it takes place between pretty much anyone. So much for sex. How about love? Some of life's most intense feelings come with first love. Neanderthals certainly went through adolescent growth spurts, but did they also have hormone-fueled emotional upheavals and crushes? Lemoustier 1 shows us that youths were already precociously strong. His upper arms are as thick as an adult man's today, making any teenage scraps a serious business. The age at which girls began to menstruate isn't known, but it's possible it marked a shift in how others treated them. However, over a lifetime, the number of times a woman bled could well have been relatively few. Depending on social dynamics, many women in traditional societies without reliable contraception tend to either be pregnant or breastfeeding. And while research with hunter-gatherer cultures on their experience of menstruation is rare, there's a trend for shorter periods too, sometimes just 2 or 3 days, compared with Western populations. One thing girls today probably share with Neanderthal teenagers is learning how to cope with discomfort from periods, and how to keep clean. Today that information might come from female relations or peers, and the same thing was probably true then. A fascinating question is whether Neanderthals understood what beginning to bleed really implied, and similarly, what intercourse might lead to 10 months on. Unlike other animals, all human cultures understand that male-female sex is directly linked to babies. If Neanderthals had also grasped this, it would have had profound social implications. Many theories have been proposed for how reproduction was organised. Male-dominated groups is one idea, supposedly backed up by the fact that at El Cidrón, all the males were from the same genetic population. In contrast, the adult women were from 2 different lineages, and researchers interpreted this as evidence they'd joined a group based around male dominance. But in fact, since the El Cidrón fossils were deposited in a jumbled mass having been washed from elsewhere in the cave system, we don't know if those individuals were even alive at the same time, much less formed a social group. Moreover, among hunter-gatherers, it's often girls who remain in the same group as their mothers. Added to this is the basic fact that Neanderthal bodies don't have any extreme size difference between the sexes, as we see in gorillas. Which means it's unlikely there were alpha males with harems. Instead, like much of humanity, Neanderthals probably had pair-bonded sexual relationships, at least mostly. That means that, unlike many other primates, parenting was more likely a shared task, and adult partnerships were long-term affairs. That food sharing was a fundamental part of Neanderthal life tells us they were used to distributing things as a way of maintaining social bonds. Maybe then, desire and devotion could be one explanation for creating and carrying small, aesthetically pleasing objects. Perhaps the Fermanis shell had been found, carefully covered in red ochre, and given as part of an intimate relationship. A love token from 50,000 years ago. Precious little ones. A different, but just as powerful bond also exists between infants and parents. Despite constant denigration of them as a species, growing, impelling forth, and sustaining babies was something at which thousands upon thousands of Neanderthal mothers succeeded. The implication of a swelling belly was very likely understood, and if so, labour might have been anticipated with excitement and apprehension. What was birth like for Neanderthals? Today it can be a life-defining event, and while circumstances vary, hormones and extraordinary physical effort often produce extremes in emotional intensity. Human labours often begin nocturnally, and instincts to seek particular places or positions can take over. Neanderthal mothers probably chose to give birth in sheltered locales, hidden from predators. Caves or rock shelters are the obvious option, and this might even be one of the motivations for seasonal visits to such sites. But unlike most mammals, human mothers often prefer to have some proximity to others, particularly the first time round. It's even been theorised that a need for birth attenders makes Homo sapiens unique. Our babies must twist on the way out, prolonging labour, making it harder to catch the baby and increasing the risk of a potentially fatal obstructed labour. Combined scans of the Tabun woman's pelvis with the Mesmiskia newborn's skull recreated their birth canals, showing no twist was needed, but their infants already had longer heads, so it was still a tight fit. Neanderthal girls certainly faced some risks from pregnancy and labour over a lifetime, and may well have witnessed death or injuries. However, maternal health has varied dramatically through history. The dire death rates in 17th century Parisian hospitals, for instance, where you were more likely than not to die giving birth, were down to high infection rates and crude medical interventions. In contrast, traditional societies with informal midwifery traditions, whether hunter-gatherers or not, can be safer. But even in other apes, birth attendance is about more than physical assistance, and intimate studies of bonobos reveal astonishingly human-like behaviour. Females will actively support the labouring mother, checking her progress by looking and touching. This isn't just curiosity or a desire to grab the baby. Female companions will stay much longer with the mother during labour than the day before or after, and they're visibly more excited before the baby arrives than after. Moreover, comforting social communications are aimed at the mother rather than to each other, and they're also obviously protective. Both flies and males are kept away, and the latter in contrast show no protective behaviour. Most amazingly, just before delivery, some experienced birth bonobo attenders were actually observed to mime catching motions towards the mother and helped hold the baby's head as it emerged, as well as assisting the mother to change position. Bonobos, of course, are famous for their female-dominated societies built around strong friendships. It's this, combined with previous experience of mothering, that seems to lead to their doula-like behaviour. In stark contrast, chimpanzees live in groups physically dominated by males, and the females generally lack same-sex adult friendships. They prefer to give birth alone and will isolate themselves afterwards. That's because infanticide is a huge risk, whether by males or other females, whereas it's never been recorded in bonobos. Most interestingly, one of the key reasons why bonobos are so different, despite females still moving between groups, is that, like Neanderthals, they don't fight over food. If resource scarcity underlies chimpanzee male aggression and therefore isolated births, then collaborative hunting and complex processes of food sharing in Neanderthals would imply the opposite. With prime foods taken back from hunts to waiting mouths, aggression within groups was far less probable, and bonobo-style female friendships could develop. With more human-like tricky birthing, it's not so outlandish to imagine Neanderthals too had midwifery tendencies. As a context of intense emotional interactions, and where transmission of knowledge and skills might affect survival, labour could be one setting in which evolution would favour increased social communication. Moreover, the potential was even greater when multiple generations lived together, giving plenty of opportunity to watch and learn childcare skills from a young age. Chimpanzee youngsters mimic infant care by cradling special rocks or pieces of wood, and small human children will, given the chance, carry tiny siblings around. The presence of experienced mothers and even grandmothers can help buffer the overwhelming experience of becoming a new parent, especially with post-birth basics, such as what to do with the placenta. A surprisingly large fleshy mass, primates often eat it, but this might be more about avoiding the attention of carnivores than nutrition. Humans tend to bury it, but whatever Neanderthals did probably varied according to where they were and even social traditions. After the placenta is passed, women typically experience bleeding known as lochia, that can be heavy and last for many days or even weeks. Although it's entirely possible for some new mothers to get up and carry on as normal. For many societies, the period of time after birth includes rest and increased support from relations. Extra quantities of the materials normally used for soaking up menstrual blood would be needed for lochia, as well as extra food. All that milk making for energy-hungry newborns would have required Neanderthal mothers to eat at least 500 extra calories per day. Once they came blinking into the world, Neanderthal babies would have been extraordinarily like ours. Their developmental milestones were almost identical, going from helpless, curled-up creatures to rambunctious toddlers within a year. They would have looked just as cute too, a vital feature, ensuring parental affection over their similarly extended childhoods. Much is made of whether they grew faster or not, but in comparison to other primates, the difference is negligible, and youngsters would have been totally dependent for many years. Remarkably, we're able to see that in some cases, babies were still largely breastfed at around a year old, thanks to ingenious analysis. At the Grotte du Renne Arcis-sur-Cure, particular proteins from growing or healing bone were found in an area where remains of a Neanderthal child, about a year old, had been found. What's more, isotopes showed the highest ever nitrogen level from any Pleistocene hominin. They're too high to come from anything except eating masses of freshwater fish, munching on carnivores, or much more probable, getting most food from breastfeeding. Even with affectionate, attentive carers, babies this young still faced risks. In many hunter-gatherer societies, sickness and infection are the biggest infant killers, and one of the tougher times comes with weaning. Along with first tastes of food other than sweet breast milk, tiny mouths take in a cocktail of new pathogens and parasites. Typically, full weaning usually happens somewhere between 2 and 4 years old, and as demand for milk lessens, the mother's fertility returns and a new sibling will soon be on the way. The age of weaning in Neanderthals is another milestone used to assess whether they grew up faster, and dental isotopes are one way to measure this. Although the methods are still very new and some are debated, barium is one isotope that's been proposed as a breast milk marker. Tracking levels in the tooth of a Neanderthal child who lived around 100,000 years ago at Skladina, Belgium, records changing amounts. It seems to have been exclusively nursing for just over 7 months before other foods were introduced. But then, not long after the baby's first birthday, the barium abruptly ceases. If barium is truly tracking breast milk consumption, such suddenness would more likely indicate that the mother was seriously ill or died. It looks nothing like normal weaning seen in humans, primates, or even earlier hominins. But interestingly, it also implies that there were no other nursing mothers able or willing to adopt this baby. More recent research using microsampling across a nearly three-year-old's tooth from around 240,000 years ago confirms that even in Neanderthals, the Skladina child's experience wasn't typical. A much more gradual weaning signal is present, with significant breastfeeding continuing until just after 2 years, when it gradually declines and stops a few months later. Perhaps one of the most joyously celebrated milestones in a bipedal hominin's life is walking. Neanderthal babies would have been carried for speed and safety, and indirect evidence of this comes from the young child from Peyre. The changes in isotopes indicate that the group moved while the baby was just a few months old, far too little to walk unaided. Moreover, it was during its first winter when some kind of protective cover or carrier would have been needed. Independent walking is itself connected in some hunter-gatherer societies to weaning, since physical closeness in a wrap or in arms promotes continued breastfeeding. Carrying tends to stop once the child is able and willing to get about without too much risk, or when they're too heavy, between 3 and 4 years old. So, if Neanderthal children were stopping breastfeeding around then or just before, this could also mark the point at which they were no longer routinely carried. Just as we hold the hands of unsteady walkers, we help babies through weaning by offering special foods. That Neanderthal mothers and babies shared food is a given, along with the mess, but can we identify baby meals? There may be a hint in the Engis child from Belgium, which has much higher nitrogen levels compared to adults from the same region. Aged around 5 or 6, it's very unlikely it was still consuming enough breast milk to explain this, and an unusual diet must be the answer. Freshwater fish is a possibility, but perhaps particular parts of reindeer or mammoth, like brains or even fermented foods, are more likely. Other parts of their bodies show that as Neanderthal children grew up, they quite quickly began to be very active. What's not certain, though, is how, or even if, childhood was conceptualised as a life stage. Undoubtedly, physical immaturity was understood and probably catered for. But did adults help youngsters learn how to be grown-ups? The presence of dental wear in very little children points to at least some imitation. The enamel on a three-year-old's front tooth from Cwm Gwnael was already worn away, potentially from tooth clamping. But there's an intriguing clue to something more from wear on the El Cidrón 1 boy's teeth. We already saw in Chapter 4 that dental microwear shows he had learned to eat by using a lithic tool to slice off food held in his mouth. But compared to older individuals, his scratches are much narrower. Either this was due to lack of confidence and tentative motions, or perhaps more likely, he was using smaller, thin-edged artifacts. It's possible he napped them himself, but fine flaking isn't always easy, and someone else may have made what was the equivalent of a child's cutlery set. Given that peer-to-peer learning was probably just as important as for other hunter-gatherers, it's interesting that at El Cidrón, the only other individual with comparable narrow dental scratches was likely a teenager. If youngsters did have artifacts made for them, it's a good marker for the existence of some kind of childhood status. But does this mean Neanderthals had toys? Humans, like many other animals, learn virtually everything through play. This includes objects, and youngsters can find fun in pretty much anything. It's possible some items with aesthetic qualities, bright colours or shiny surfaces, could have entertained little ones, but the time taken to produce many of them, combined with the use of relatively rare materials or substances, argues against that. Of course, many toys are often simplified or miniaturized versions of practical items. Specially sized artifacts just might be visible, however, in some of the Schöningen spears that are noticeably shorter than others. They're clearly not pretend weapons, but perhaps sized for, or by, smaller hands. A lakeside ambush could have been a relatively safe setting for learners, where thrashing horses were disadvantaged enough to allow practice spearing by youngsters with eyes wide, hearts thudding. After the hunt would come butchery, another crucial skill. Most diminutive lithics can't be counted as playthings since small size is often caused by resharpening. Genuinely micro objects like tiny Levallois points or bladelets were systematically produced and probably not the work of children, because the techniques concerned were tricky. But that doesn't mean they weren't also useful for little fingers to practice with, just like the minuscule, carefully done cut marks on small birds at Cova Negra might fall somewhere on the spectrum of play and survival skills that children's games are really all about. Look after us. Childhood was an introduction to a life full of dangers, as well as excitements. Injuries and illness, sometimes severe, are very common in hunter-gatherer societies, and Neanderthals were no different. Strikingly, however, numerous bones testify that some outlasted their maladies. Proving whether this happened thanks to the kindness of others is, however, complicated. The Devil's Tower child from Gibraltar was just 2 or 3 when his jaw was fractured, and very likely required help from adults to eat. But while assisting toddlers might be expected, the other cases in more mature individuals are harder to be sure about. The Lemoustier I teenager's jaw had also been badly broken at some point in older childhood, and probably affected his ability to eat, but it's impossible to say if he just soldiered on or was cared for. At the other end of the scale, obviously toothless Neanderthal elders like at La Chapelle-aux-Saints existed, but so too with chimpanzees who managed to cling on to life despite receiving no help or special soft foods. This is a reminder that assumptions about what requires care will depend on one's own culture and experience. What animals do vary significantly. Chimpanzees and particularly bonobos do give comfort to upset or injured individuals, but don't consistently help others or provide provisions. In contrast, highly social creatures like elephants and cetaceans act together to support their injured, sometimes physically. And strikingly, lions, wolves, and even mongooses will occasionally bring food to incapacitated adults. What's noticeable here is that far more than apes, these species are by nature collaborative hunters and foragers. Single Neanderthals could likely not survive long outside their group. If injuries or sickness were a routine part of life, then individuals requiring assistance, along with infants, mothers, or those born with different bodily conditions, would have been all around, not anomalies. Just as killing, butchering, and eating animals involved shared action and rewards, then it makes evolutionary sense that needy individuals at least sometimes were helped. A few really beat-up Neanderthals are hard to explain without something like this. The dreadful head injury suffered by the Saint-Césaire woman would probably have caused confusion and certainly massive blood loss, and she must have been helped at least temporarily. Similarly, Shanidar III might have been lucky and avoided a collapsed lung after their chest was stabbed. But they may have struggled with breathing and walking. They hung on for more than 2 weeks before death, and given the increased calorie needs of Neanderthal bodies, this seems a long time to survive if nobody was bringing them food. But it's Shanidar I who is the most convincing case for long-term support. Probably partially blind, certainly deaf in at least one ear, with hugely reduced mobility and a chopped-off arm, he nevertheless endured to a ripe old age, even adding arthritis to his aches and pains. Despite his mobility issues, Shanidar I's leg bones record normal levels of activity, and he obviously adapted to a one-handed adult existence. It would be astonishing if he overcame all this entirely alone. He clearly didn't exist at the margins, and after recuperating, probably contributed to gathering and even small game hunting. But he was probably provisioned with meat from big game for the rest of his life, and also protected. Maybe the true marker between how some animals care for each other and the lengths humans go to is in medical skills. Chimpanzees' habit of eating bioactive substances probably helps with parasites or mineral balance. But this might be about taste preference rather than truly understanding the bodily effects. Chimps will sometimes dab at their own wounds with leaves, and intriguingly, orangutans have been seen applying chewed up leaves to their skin, of the same species used by local indigenous cultures for pain relief. Even so, that's still a far cry from the way we draw on natural resources in myriad ways to produce tisanes, poultices, unguents and other treatments. There's no clear-cut evidence of herbalism in Neanderthals, but their deep knowledge of plants means it's not entirely unfeasible. An important cue to plants' medicinal characteristics can be distinct, often bitter tastes, which Neanderthals could detect and tolerate. When probable yarrow and chamomile were identified as being consumed at El Cidrón, claims that these herbs were used as medicines attracted much media attention. But they're both also used as flavourings, so the motivations remain hazy. Really, the proof of self-medication is indirect, from healing and lack of infection in horrific wounds like those of Shanidar I, the Saint-Césaire woman, or the giant skull wound and another potential amputation at Krapina. By the time he died, Shanidar I would certainly have been wise as well as old. But was his age out of the ordinary? Very small populations of Neanderthals combined with a high percentage of skeletons being young adult males makes it seem on the surface like lifespans must have been pretty short. If true, that would have serious implications. Prime-aged men would be dying off before they'd had much time to reproduce. But all this rests on assuming that the fossils accurately reflect the age range of the living. One indicator that this is not the case is a drastic underrepresentation of female bodies. And as we'll see in the next chapter, cadavers were sometimes ending up in the archaeological record after Neanderthals had been doing things to them. Given all this, the fact that there are relatively few identifiable elderly, over 60 years old, individuals can't really be taken as proof Neanderthals were dying well before their biological time. Although there were likely never hordes of hoary old ones, just as in recent hunter-gatherer societies, three living generations was probably normal for Neanderthals. And growing up with grandparents matters for two key reasons. First, casual babysitting is extremely useful as it frees adults to find more food or do other tasks. Second, in addition to reinforcing what children learn from parents, grandparents are more likely to be competent in complex skills, whether producing hafting recipes, tracking, or even medical care. Knowledge and experience from a lifetime accumulates and beds down into wisdom. Elders would have been fundamentally important to the wider group too, since those Neanderthals who made it to 40 would have been gold mines in times of crisis. They could remember old ways, where things used to be, what to do when herds failed or the weather behaved in ways out of anyone else's memory. This store of sagacity extended to generations before, through what they had learned from their own parents and grandparents. Such insights could make the difference between surviving and perishing. Neanderthal elders might also have been important to the group's social history. If they understood that sex would beget children, some notion of kin lineages would have existed too. Knowing who was related to who is obviously useful during everyday life. But if gatherings between groups, whether planned or not, did take place, it might have been even more vital. Among hunter-gatherers, aside from resources, one of the key motivations for travelling long distances is for socialising, including finding sexual partners. Not all Neanderthals were inbred in genetic terms, and keeping track of who moved groups and which were friendly or hostile would be most powerful in the most senior Neanderthal memories. If we accept that Neanderthals had some level of speech and could project their minds in time and space as they planned moves, portioned out carcasses, or made composite tools, then the existence of storytellers doesn't sound so implausible. Tales emerge from lived experience. And in orally based cultures around the world, it's largely via stories that collective wisdom is conserved. In hunter-gatherers, the commonalities in stories are striking, often merging ecological information, social norms, and cultural origins. Details of the surrounding world are understood and rationalized through relational ideas. Sometimes ancient tales from widely separated cultures are remarkably similar. Celestial cosmologies from ancient Greece and the Aboriginal Australian Kothaka people both include three bright astronomical star groupings. For Orion, there is Nearuna. For the Hyades in Taurus, there is Cambaguda. And for the Pleiades or Seven Sisters, there is the Eugorilla Sisters. The stories from almost opposite sides of the world explaining these constellations are virtually identical. A male hunter pursuing a group of women thwarted by another entity. The common theme of chase may have emerged in response to the way these stars rise and move across the sky. Seen this way, nature tells its own story, and people merely repeat it to one another. We might imagine Neanderthal tales to have worked in a comparable way, and if cultural lore of all sorts was transmitted by mouth, it becomes a kind of time travel, potentially allowing a group to know things that took place a century ago through the memories of elders. Sometimes stories might have been spectacularly ancient. Particularly strong evidence comes from some Aboriginal cultures, where knowledge of subtle changes in star brightness was maintained over centuries, as well as the 4-millennia-old experience of a meteorite impact. Most astonishing is the 10,000-year-old cultural memory in Australian coastal communities that the oceans rose at the end of the last ice age. Perhaps Neanderthals too remembered how the world of their ancestors changed through millennial-scale climate shifts, and found stories in constellations no living person has seen. The emotional existence of Neanderthals who lived, worked, ate, and slept together was rich and based on cooperation. Their collective hunting was mirrored in the sharing of meat and the arrangements of their sites. Born into loving arms, they grew up into complicated social beings, driven as much as we are by passions both devotional and destructive. And like an amplification of sound, collaboration within Neanderthal groups may well have evolved in tandem with multiple generations and storytelling. In a world unhazed by light pollution, the night sky arcing above their heads and the regularly shifting moon may have become part of murmured songs around a fire. Certainly, place itself and how it's bound up with experiences and memories of relations with things, animals, and others would be central to how they understood the world. When histories and lineages merge with land, what happens to the bodies of the dead becomes one of the most powerful ways to invest a place with social potency.